that they prefer to remain silent, rather than risk the accusation of being called anti-Semitic, if they frankly and openly express their views. The same holds true for letters to the editor. From a reading of letters to the editor in any metropolitan newspaper, when an issue involving Israel is in the news, one would conclude that 95% of the people of the US passionately support the Israeli position on the issue. This again is a gross error. Most non-Jews simply do not write to the editor, or say or write anything publicly which can be construed by Jewish sensitivities or the Anti-Defamation League as anti-Semitic. As far as the greater part of the Jewish community is concerned, anything less than wholehearted support for any Israeli position, however unreasonable, is by definition anti-Semitic. Indeed, there is a serious question whether, if such letters to the editor were written, they would even be published, because many newspaper editors are even more sensitive to the taboo than their readers. So programmed have our leaders become, that the very instant the buzzword anti-Semitic is heard, there is an automatic knee-jerk reaction, a hasty attempt to retract, apologize, placate, anything to avoid the awful charge of anti-Semitism. Thus, it is not simply the financial and political power of the Israeli lobby that is the source of its influence, but also the pervasive, quiet, unspoken censorship of the taboo, which the Israeli lobby exploits to the fullest. The Anti-Defamation League and the First Amendment. The Anti-Defamation League was originally formed many years ago as a defense against slanderous and libelous attacks on Jews and the Jewish community. Its record over the years, in this respect, has been highly successful. However, inasmuch as there is little, if any, slander, libel, or defamation against Jews anymore, the League in recent years has extended its activities to monitoring the various media, to detect and react against any utterances which the League considers might be anti-Semitic. This can be anything which is judged by the League as unfriendly, unflattering, or critical toward a Jew, Jews, Zionism or Israel, or even if a congressman or senator votes for only $3 billion instead of $4 billion in grants to Israel. Needless to say, simply having the power to define anti-Semitism in any particular context, which the League freely asserts, is a highly effective method of stifling even the most legitimate criticism or comment. Thus, all that is required to smother any objective consideration of issues involving, say, for example, Israel, is simply to define any contrary position as anti-Semitic. Since there is absolutely no defense against the charge of anti-Semitism, most prudent people have long since preferred silence on sensitive issues to the risk of exposing themselves to the accusation of anti-Semitism, with its inevitable Hitler and Holocaust associations. This not too subtle form of intimidation operates as a de facto abridgment of freedom of speech. In other words, it is a highly effective form of censorship, which imposes a clear prior restraint on what can safely be said in this country on certain and often highly important subjects. In an article, entitled "A Certain Anxiety," appearing in the August 1971 issue of the prestigious Jewish magazine, Commentary, Norman Podhoretz, editor and publisher, explains the taboo as follows. Now it is perfectly true that anti-Zionism is not necessarily anti-Semitism. But it is also true, I fear, that the distinction between the two is often invisible to the naked Jewish eye, and that anti-Zionism has served to legitimize the other expression of a good deal of anti-Semitism which might otherwise have remained subject to the taboo against anti-Semitism that prevailed in American public life from the time of Hitler until, roughly, the Six-Day War. And it is more than anything else the breaking of the taboo against the open expression of hostility to Jews, which has caused some of us to feel a certain anxiety about the Jewish population in America. It is so long since overt hostility to Jews has been regarded as a permissible attitude in America, that we cannot say what consequence, if any, might follow this inhibition. Emphasis supplied, a similar concern was expressed in another article by Podhoretz appearing in the February 1972 issue of Commentary, entitled "Is It Good for the Jews?" During the period running from the end of the Second World War to the middle or late 60s, Jews had no need to ask whether anything was good for the Jews, for the simple and sufficient reason that in America at least almost everything was good for the Jews. Antisemitism still existed, mainly on the political right, but so discredited had it become through its association with the name of Hitler that no one who aspired to respectable status in American public life dared voice antisemitic sentiments openly, or dared make any use of antisemitism in appealing for the support of others. For the penalty was instant banishment from the world of acceptable opinion. Whether or not, then, the actual level of antisemitic feeling declined in America, the sheer number of antisemitic statements, or indeed of statements hostile to Jews in any way, or to any degree, most certainly did decline in the public prints, on the airways, in political speeches, and probably even in private conversations. Emphasis supplied, the taboo thus described, raises some disturbing questions, as well as some novel concepts, as far as our First Amendment freedoms are concerned. We have assumed that the American Civil Liberties Union, ACLU, had long ago made clear to Americans the meaning of our sacred guarantees of freedom of speech and press, as well as the evils of censorship. True, the taboo referred to by Poteretz is not censorship imposed by the government. However, if one dares not voice any statements hostile to Jews in any way, or to any degree, even in private conversation, the operative restraint on free speech is even more insidious. The very concept of a taboo is, of course, a negation of the essential spirit of our Constitution. In the language of the U.S. Supreme Court, the command of the First Amendment is that falsehoods and fallacies must be exposed, not suppressed. American Communication Assn. C.iou Douds, NY 70s Court 674, 339 U.S. 382. Surely the ACLU, which is a champion of unpopular causes, would find enormous difficulty in reconciling its concept of civil liberties with the existence of a taboo. From any viewpoint, as has been said, it constitutes a de facto infringement upon freedom of speech and press with all of the evils inherent therein. If in this country, one dare not make any statement that is in any way, or to any degree hostile to Jews, what is hostile, who is to judge? Poteretz himself points out that the distinction between antisemitism and anti-Zionism, to the naked Jewish eye, is often invisible. Since the accusation of antisemitism can be made in disregard of such invisible distinctions, without risk to the accuser, or deference to the accused, the power exists to deny respectable status in American public life to anyone who voices any opinion or expresses any view unpopular with the Jewish community or the Anti-Defamation League, ADL. This, however, is not the only penalty to be suffered by anyone breaking the taboo. According to Poteretz, they will suffer instant banishment from the world of acceptable opinion. But what is acceptable opinion? Acceptable to whom? Both Nazi Germany and Soviet Russia have always offered total freedom to voice acceptable opinions. A good example of what can happen when someone dares to express an unacceptable opinion is the case of General George Brown, former chairman of the U.S. Joint Chiefs of Staff. In a press interview, the text of which was released on October 17, 1976, he was asked by a reporter the speaking about the Middle East, are Israel and its forces more of a burden or more of a blessing to the US from a purely military point of General Brown's frank and honest answer was, well, I think it's just got to be considered a burden. He answers the question more fully by explaining that someday Israel might actually be a tremendous asset. General Brown's answer was that, from a military standpoint, Israel was a burden at that time, because a vital U.S. tank reserve in Europe had been depleted to replace Israel's losses in the Yom Kippur War, leaving the U.S. with less than 50% of the tanks necessary for the defense of NATO. Also, that the U.S. is sending certain new weapons systems to Israel, which we have not yet supplied to our own armed forces. The Los Angeles Times the following day, in a calm and reasoned editorial, pointed out that Brown was right. He had merely acknowledged that U.S. military support of Israel is costing billions of dollars annually. That, the Times said, clearly adds up to a burden, rather than a blessing, and no good purpose would be served by pretending otherwise. nowhere. It should be emphasized, did General